This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, January the 9th, 2006. From WPFW in Washington, D.C., I am Selena Masuda, sitting in for Auda Bogado. Columbus, Ohio's African and Black communities demand police accountability for a Somali youth's death. Hong Kong activists call for a dismissal of charges against WTO protesters, and violence continues to escalate in southern Iraq. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Republican Congressman Tom DeLay will leave his position as House Majority Leader. Ingrid Drake reports from Washington, D.C.
In the midst of federal investigations into lawbreaking and ethics violations of lobbyist Jack Abramoff and several congressmembers and their staff, Speaker of the House J. Hennis Hastert announced yesterday he will, quote, move forward aggressively and quickly to address lobbying reform. Mary Boyle with Common Cause, a D.C.-based citizens lobbying group.
We are seeing a lot of reform proposals right now come out of Congress, and when Congress gets back in town, we will be seeing even more. One of our main concerns is there has been no enforcement at all of rules that do exist. Certainly, we have some very, very serious and substantive reform proposals, but we also need to start enforcing the rules that are out there.
The election of a new House Majority Leader is scheduled for the week of January 30th. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake.
The fatal shooting of an undocumented Mexican teenager by a Border Patrol officer along the San Diego-Tijuana border has outraged Mexican authorities, adding more tension to the complicated immigration debate between both countries. Luis Perez reports from Tijuana.
Guillermo Martinez was shot in the back on Friday, December 30th, while attempting to enter illegally into the U.S. After being shot, Martinez ran back to Mexico, where he died hours later in a local hospital. The incident was promptly condemned by Mexican federal authorities as well as civil leaders and human rights defenders on both sides of the border. The fatal shooting comes at a particularly tense moment between Mexico and the United States after the U.S. House passed an immigration measure to extend and fortify the metal fence along the common border. Investigations into the shooting are underway by Mexican and U.S. authorities. The results are due in 30 days. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Luis Perez in Tijuana.
A study conducted by Indian and Canadian researchers has concluded that millions of abortions based on the gender of the fetus have caused a lopsided female-to-male ratio in India. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
The British medical journal The Lancet reports that an estimated 10 million female births have been selectively aborted in the last 20 years. The Indian society has been traditionally male-dominated, and many families consider girls as a liability, especially when they are to be married off with a huge dowry. The research found that educated classes have the tendency to selectively abort females when previous children had been girls. Though sex determination and sex-selective abortions are illegal in India, the business in this sector, all equipped with the latest technology, has been widespread in major cities. Female births have been on the decline in the past decade. Today, the ratio stands at 933 females for every 1,000 males. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
A particularly harsh winter is adding to the miseries of the survivors of the October 8th earthquake in Kashmir. Shanawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
Temperatures have dropped below freezing in Kashmir, and most of the quake survivors in Indian-administered Kashmir are living in tin sheds, highly inadequate for the harsh winters. It has been one of the chilliest winters in decades. Aid workers in the region are reporting a lack of fuels, like firewood, necessary to keep warm in the harsh winters. Heavy snowfall in the last week has left some villages inaccessible, creating shortages of food and essential supplies. The Voluntary Association Network, a local organization working in the relief efforts, has warned of higher casualties in the absence of heating arrangements. The United States military has doubled cargo loads on its helicopters to the remote affected areas in Pakistan-administered Kashmir to ensure adequate supplies in the region before snows pile higher. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shanawaz Khan.
Another toxic spill has polluted a major waterway in China, and a capsized boat full of chemicals could potentially cause further problems. Dante Tosa reports from Hong Kong.
Sunday morning, a boat containing hundreds of tons of sulfuric acid sank and capsized at the bottom of the Yangtze River, the longest-running river in Asia. According to the official press reports, the sunken cargo boat contained at least 260 tons of sulfuric acid. This would be the fourth major chemical accident to affect a Chinese river in the last 3 months. Last week, Xiangjiang River was polluted by an industrial cadmium spill. According to the state-run Xinhua News Agency, at the height of the spill, cadmium level was at 25.6 times greater than the safety standard. Cadmium is carcinogenic and is extremely toxic even in low concentrations. Media report indicates that water will probably not be shut off along the route of the cadmium spill. As for the sunken boat containing hundreds of tons of sulfuric acid, there have not been any reports of the recovery of the boat by either of the official news agencies. From Hong Kong, this is Dante Toza for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee opens its confirmation hearing for Judge Samuel Alito to be U.S. Supreme Court Justice. If confirmed, Alito would replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. As Justice O'Connor is regarded as a moderate conservative and swing vote on the court, many believe Alito will go through a much more contentious confirmation battle than Chief Justice John Roberts did several months ago. Yan May is in the hearing room at Capitol Hill.
Committee Chairman Pennsylvania Republican Arlen Specter says Chief Justice John Roberts has pledged allegiance to the judicial principle of modesty and stability, and it's unlikely he will change the direction of the Supreme Court. Therefore, Alito will not be a critical swing vote if he's confirmed. In a 1985 memo, Alito stated, "The Constitution does not provide a right to an abortion." Specter says Alito has to explain how his personal belief will impact his judicial decisions.
This hearing will give Judge Alito the public forum to address the issue, as he has with senators in private meetings, that his personal views and prior advocacy will not determine his judicial decision, but instead he will weigh factors such as stare decisis, that is, what are the precedents, that he will weigh women's and men's too reliance on Roe, and he will consider too whether Roe is, quote, embedded in the culture of our nation.
Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy is the most powerful Democrat on the committee. He says Alito has to demonstrate his ability to maintain judicial independence at a time of inflated presidential power.
The president has, outside the law, been conducting secret and warrantless spying on Americans for more than 4 years. This is a time when the protections of Americans' liberties are directly at risk, as are the checks and balances that have served to constrain abuses of power for more than 200 years. The Supreme Court's relied upon by all of us to protect our fundamental rights.
Alito argued in 1984, an executive branch official who authorized the illegal wiretapping of U.S. citizens without a warrant should be immune from lawsuits. Senator Edward Kennedy, a Democrat of Massachusetts, was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee when Alito was confirmed to be a judge on the Third Court of Appeals. Kennedy says Alito vowed to be an impartial judge during the hearing, but his judicial record has been troubling.
In a study by the well-respected expert Professor Cass Sunstein of the University of Chicago Law School, Judge Alito was found to rule against the individual in 84% of his dissents. To put it plainly, average Americans have had a hard time getting a fair shake in his courtroom.
Following Kennedy's scathing comments, Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley gives an embracing remark.
From all accounts, Judge Alito has an impressive and extensive legal and judicial record, certainly one worthy of someone on the Supreme Court.
Republicans remind Alito that he does not have to be forthcoming. Democrats demand Alito to answer questions fully and honestly. Most senators declare they remain open-minded until the confirmation hearing concludes. But a block away from the hearing room, in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, demonstrators have already made verdicts on Alito.
Women must decide their fate.
For Alito!
most contention surrounds the issue of abortion rights. People from both pro-choice and pro-life camps are eager to prove their own beliefs the truth and the opposition dead and wrong.
3,500 babies that are slaughtered every day in the United States.
Not
is that
babies,
okay with
they're
you?
They're fetuses, they're potential babies.
No, sir,
they're not human beings.
Little one. It's the beginning. Everything's this, about a baby.
The confirmation hearing will last through the entire week. Tomorrow morning, senators will start the first round of questions. The Senate will vote on the nominee on January the 20th. I'm Ye Meixie at Capitol Hill.
After a week of escalating violence in Iraq, the conditions in the south of the country continue to deteriorate, with almost 500 Iraqis either dead or injured. The lack of infrastructure and reconstruction is taking its toll in the region, which has previously showed progress and has been cited as an area without high security problems. FSRN's Salam Talib spoke to Iraqi activist Iman Ahamash about the situation in the south.
Now, in the south, where the situation is supposed to be safe, I mean, the security is supposed to be established and etc., there is no resistance, there are no terrorists, as they call them, but the situation is even worse. I was in Basra, I spent almost a week in Basra, and Basra is simply has become a dumping, you know, garbage dumping place.
Meanwhile, the city of Nasiriyah, 380 kilometers south of Baghdad, has been closed for the third day after demonstrations by the city's unemployed. Demanding economic relief, the protesters were attacked and shot by the Iraqi military and Iraqi police, wounding many and killing 21. Today, the police announced that security arrangements in the city have been put on high alert. The head of the security forces, Abdul Amir Manati, said that they were not responding to locals. He said that the violence is a result of strangers that have arrived in the city. But Abdul Sattar al-Azawi, a journalist in Nasiriyah, spoke with FSRN about the demonstration.
In Nasiriyah, كان هناك احتجاجات على
The people of Nasiriyah have been making demonstrations because of the high percentage of unemployment. And this is caused by corruption in the city's leadership, especially by employing people according to their political affiliation or to their families. In the south of Iraq, most of the leadership is led by parties or by families. So the police and the military respond so aggressively against the people, and this is because of the corruption. Responding to Muqtada al-Sadr's request for an explanation of the violence at the demonstration, the Iraqi government is conducting an investigation.
With Salam Talib, this is Eliana Kaya reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Comandante Ramona, a tiny Tzotzil indigenous woman who strategized the takeover of San Cristobal de las Casas Chiapas during the January 1, 1994 armed uprising, died in the early morning hours of January the 6th. Ramona was driven from her highlands home to San Cristobal de las Casas clinic, where the Zapatista leader's frail body succumbed to an infectious tuberculosis and kidney failure. Luz Ruiz and Tim Russo report from Chiapas.
Late on Friday, January 6, in the midst of a meeting for the Zapatistas' other campaign in Tonalá, Subcomandante Marcos Stutter pulled back and unexpectedly announced the death of 47-year-old Comandante Ramona. He spoke only a moment, saying, "The world has lost an exemplary woman. The world and Mexico has lost one of those fighters that it needs. A piece of our heart has been ripped out." Comandante Ramona was a founding member of the Zapatista National Liberation Army and a civilian commander that led the taking of San Cristobal de las Casas on January 1, 1994. Although she had virtually no formal education, she pushed for and was instrumental in formulating the Zapatistas' Revolutionary Women's Law and has been inspirational to the struggle for equal rights for women throughout Mexico. A traditional weaver by trade, she broke the government's military circle when she went to Mexico City to speak in front of nearly 100,000 people on October 12, 1996, Dia de la Raza, demanding that then-President Zedillo respect the partial peace accords. The last time Ramona spoke publicly was during the September 17, 2005 rebel plenary session in La Garrucha to organize the other campaign.
Muy buenas noches, compañeras, compañeros. Es mi nombre.
Good evening, compañeras and compañeros. My name is Comandante Ramona. I am very pleased that all of you have come here and that there are many of you. We want to send our greetings to you so that you will put all your energy into this work and so that we can begin to work together. Those are my words. Gracias.
Amidst flowers, prayers, and songs, Ramona's funeral was a very private event. Hundreds of Zapatistas or port bases paid respects to the comandante's family. Among those present was a diverse contingent of indigenous men and women, activists, and longtime supporters of the Zapatista movement. Comandante Ramona, you live in every woman that struggles, was one of the many messages inscribed in the floral arrangements that were placed on her grave in San Andres Larrainsar. Her resting place, surrounded by colorful flowers, was marked by a simple wooden black cross that family members inscribed with her real name, Maria Diaz Santis, died January 6, 2006. Afterwards, in the fresh cement that covered the grave, they inscribed her nom de guerre, Comandante Ramona. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Luz Ruiz and Tim Russo in San Cristobal de las Casas, Chiapas.
Over 300 local Hong Kong activists marched with 11 Korean farmers on Sunday to the Hong Kong police headquarters demanding that charges against the farmers be dropped immediately. The 11 Korean farmers were arrested and charged with unlawful assembly during protests at last month's World Trade Organization ministerial conference. The farmers, who were also arrested with three other WTO protesters, are on their sixth day of hunger strike and say they will continue indefinitely. In solidarity, a group calling itself the International Campaign for the Immediate Release of WTO Political Prisoners is calling for international solidarity to support them. FSRN's Mai Kim reports.
Yang Kyung-kyu, Vice President of the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, was one of the 14 protesters charged with unlawful assembly after clashing with the police during the World Trade Organization meetings last month. He is out on bail after being detained for 6 days.
3명이 넘는 인원을 연행했지만 저희 이 경찰이
The police arrested over 1,000 protesters. Within 48 hours, they had to find people who committed the violence. But it was impossible for them to recognize 1,000 people by checking videos or photos. And actually, 1,000 protesters did not commit tremendous violence. So I think it must have been hard for the police to choose them. Before they used videos and photos, they selected 13 people at random, and they chose me because I was a leader of the anti-WTO protests.
Of the 14 awaiting trial, 11 are Korean, one is Taiwanese, one is Japanese, and one is from mainland China. While awaiting trial, 12 of the protesters launched a hunger strike at a dock of Hong Kong 6 days ago.
경찰의 무리한 기소에 의해서 부당하게 대우받고 있고
We've been treated unfairly due to the unreasonable prosecution by the police, and our legal struggle has been distorted. So 12 of us started a hunger strike to show that our struggle is justifiable and that anti-WTO protests should continue.
Jin-suk Lee is with the KCTU. She says the 14 protesters' human rights have been violated.
They're released on bail, but they have no contacts with their families. They can't work. You know, a lot of them are the sole breadwinners, they're farmers. They can't go back and support their families because they're detained in Hong Kong. They can't leave Hong Kong.
Elizabeth Tang is with the Hong Kong People's Alliance on WTO. She says that the charge should be dropped immediately and that they should be sent back to their families.
Until now, the police in Hong Kong have not been able to find any concrete evidence to show that they have committed violence. So we believe this charge is a political one, and therefore the charge should be dropped.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Mia Kim.
The recent police shooting in Columbus, Ohio, of a Somali youth who suffered mental health problems has sent waves of shock and resentment throughout the Black and African communities there, and has provoked demands for an examination of police use of force policies. Evan Davis files this report.
An estimated 600 to 800 Somali residents held a peaceful rally on December 30th in front of Columbus's City Hall to denounce the shooting of Nasir Abdi, a Somali man with a history of mental illness who was fatally shot by Franklin County Sheriff's deputies during an altercation 2 days earlier. The officers involved reported that Mr. Abdi threatened them with a knife, but eyewitness testimonies are conflicting as to whether or not Mr. Abdi was armed. The Sheriff's Department is currently conducting an investigation and declined to comment while that investigation is pending, but many Somalis here feel that the use of lethal force in this instance is not sufficiently justified. Abdallah Jama is a vice president of the Somali Community Association of Ohio.
This particular case needs to be investigated properly. The boy was mentally unfit. He has been here more than 6-7 years, and he speaks English fluently. And all the members of his family were there, and they all speak English. With help, this was avoidable.
The police were called initially by Mr. Abdi's own parents, who sought professional assistance in apprehending their son so that he could receive emergency mental health treatment. But the officers who responded were not trained in handling the mentally ill and were not equipped with tasers or other so-called non-lethal weapons other than aerosol mace, which the officers used, they claimed, to no avail. Somali community representative Liban Ismail helped to draft the press release that was presented at the rally.
The sheriffs knew that the subject was unstable and agitated. Their mission was to take the subject in custody and present him to a mental health facility for treatment. Instead, Nasser Abdi was brutally shot and killed by the deputies. This young man was killed when in fact he was supposed to be protected by the authorities.
Opinions as to why Mr. Abdi was shot are not limited to the question of police training. At the rally, Somalis and others speculated openly as to whether or not race may have been a factor. Adam O'Hersey spoke to reporters shortly after the official press conference in front of City Hall.
And what appalls the Somali community very much is the prevalent belief. If Abdi was of different color, or if Abdi lived in a different neighborhood, things shouldn't have happened the way they have happened. That's what scares us the most.
Columbus is home to the second largest Somali population in the U.S., over 30,000 and growing, but police relations in Somali neighborhoods are not vastly different than in other predominantly African-American parts of the city, according to Asad Shabazz, co-chair of the Ohio Coalition of Concerned Black Citizens.
To me, they're Somalians by ethnicity, but they're black folks. Already have been harassed by the police over and over and over again. So I don't care if the cop was justified, because the sheriff's office and the Columbus Police Department do not make it a priority to have a relationship with the community. In the eyes of the people, they're guilty anyway.
Shabazz emphasized the need for not only police training, but for a community policing approach in which officers develop personal relationships with the citizens in the precincts they patrol. That, he says, would be a deterrent to the use of deadly force.
What has to happen? First of all, training. Officers need to be trained. Relationship building. You do not shoot people that you like. You don't. You find every other alternative than putting a bullet in them.
Shabazz formerly served on the Columbus Community Relations Commission, a city-funded organization that facilitates dialogue between concerned groups of citizens and law enforcement agencies. Napoleon Bell is the current assistant executive director of the commission, which is currently establishing what he calls a community intervention team in response to the Abdi shooting.
We look toward educating the public about why the police do what they do. We have several things that we are working toward this year that will provide the community a way to interact with the police and have a better understanding about what they do.
Bell explained, however, that the commission is not empowered to make policy recommendations. Meanwhile, some both in and out of the Somali community are exploring the idea of a civilian review board, which would give citizens a degree of oversight over police policies. Adnan Mirza is the executive director of the Ohio Council on American Islamic Relations.
And I think that would be a good idea, and I think that would certainly be a step forward in the, in the healing process here. If people know that there's some checks and balances in the system to safeguard them, I think that's something that should be looked into.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Columbus, Ohio.
Since the 1950s, Britain's policy of free cradle-to-grave health care for all its citizens has been renowned worldwide. But recently, leaked government papers have proved what public health workers have suspected for a long time, that the British government is permanently opening up the doors to private companies to take over large parts of the public health care system. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
We're seeing bed closures, closure of wards, getting rid of staff, in some cases operations being put off. Community hospitals are being closed. Around the edges, we're starting to see charges creeping in,
Dr. Jackie Davis is a consultant radiologist with Britain's Public Health Service.
I think if we continue down the road towards the market, then it will mean the fragmentation and ultimate end of the public health service in this country.
It wouldn't be so bad, say public health sector workers, if increased private sector involvement in public health was helping to resolve the massive delays in treatment and the financial crisis. But the public health service deficits are getting worse, not better. This year, there may be as much as £900 million in the red. And British patients are still enduring some of the longest waiting times for operations in Europe.
I've got a high tolerance of pain, but that pain was beyond a joke. Last Christmas, I thought to myself, I'm not going to see another Christmas. I can't put up with it. I was totally convinced I was going to kill myself. I know I would have done it because I just couldn't stand it.
April Dollery needed urgent spinal surgery. But like many other cash-strapped public hospitals in Britain have started to do, they've cut their operating backlog by refusing to operate on her because she's overweight. Unable to afford to go private in Britain, she outsourced her operation to India.
I tried to say to the surgeon in England and here in Worcester, I'm not mobile, therefore I won't lose weight. And I said that I will sign any forms he likes, saying that I won't sue him if it goes wrong. And he just said no. But the surgeon over in India said, what's the problem? He said, we'll do it. Since he did the operation, my weight has fallen off me.
Lawyer Richard Stein has represented a number of patients suing the public health service who've been forced to pay for their own treatment in another country and want to be reimbursed.
The government is rationing healthcare by waiting list, and the fundamental problem is that they're not prepared to bite the bullet of telling people that they need to pay more if they want to have a good health service. But given that health is the most important thing for all of us, it must be a sign of a civilised society that we put the money in to deliver the health service that everybody needs.
Last week, Richard Stein and his client won the backing of the European Court of Justice in a landmark case. The court agreed that British patients should have the right to reimbursement if they're forced to outsource their operations to other countries because of undue delays in waiting times. It's the first case to challenge the practices of the public health service under EU law.
Clearly, it shouldn't be that you have to go abroad to have basic healthcare provision. That is obviously a complete anomaly. But as a safety valve, it's obviously better than having to wait around and not have the treatment at all. The government is obsessed about privatising whatever moves. I'm just not convinced at the moment that what the government are proposing is going to do anything other than line the pockets of yet more not very impressive private sector providers, as has happened in the railways and many other areas that we're aware of in Britain.
Public health sector workers are launching a campaign against further private sector involvement in public health, and they're hoping the government will listen. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Washington editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Padgett-Seekins and Eric Klein. In Washington, D.C., I'm Selena Masuda, sitting in for Auda Bogado.